I know this is called a poetry series, but I'm going to read mostly hybrid nonfiction. But I actually wrote this prose poem in the Mad Women Workshop after I finished my MFA, which is how I met Joan. So I felt this was an appropriate poem to read. It is a reimagining of Little Red Riding Hood, and it's called Animal You'll Surely Become. Okay. One. My mother sent me into the woods, pushed me gently forward, and locked the wooden door against the snow. I met my father on the path, his back a jagged mountainside. He smelled my mother's blood, reached through the trees, traced my face and neck with his claws. Hush, he said. Grandmother found me. She burned the tattered red cape that lay at my feet, washed in my naked body, picked the wolf's coat from my torn skin, slicked back my wet hair, and whispered, hush. Hush, child. Hush, the locks clicked, the gnashing teeth, the pumping heart, the blood of the wolf in the lungs inside you. Hush, the howl, child. Animal you'll surely become. Two. My daughter was born in winter from the belly of the hunter. I stitched her inside him myself with golden string, a pregnant carcass in the snow. He was beautiful. Three. My dearly beloved, we are the hunted. You too are animal, muscled, matted fur, twitching back. One day your skin will grow too tight. You will finger your scalp and pull at your eyelids, open your mouth wide in the mirror, and then your dress will stretch until the buttons pop and fur will cover you like gray morning. The fear will come first and then the hunger. When you are naked, you must run. Run with your hunchback exposed through the field and over the river. Run to the woods and disappear. They will try to take everything from you, but please remember to rake the bark and open the flesh of trees. Claim the woods as your own. Please believe your body is capable against machines and silver bullets. Do not fear man and mothers and fathers and guns and burnt rubber. Girl with a crown of bone, fill your lungs, show your teeth, howl for your mother. It's the only thing that will scare them. So if you like weird stuff like that, my books are sale. This is a essay I just published that is called A Daughter's Guide to Ghosts. And it's broken up from my great grandmother, my grandmother, my mom, and me. So Flora. Nana's mother, Flora, heard the tapping as she changed into her nightgown. She knew it was him before she saw the pleading face in the window. Please speak to me, Flora, the dead man said. Please speak to me. Sometimes in dreams and sometimes as ghosts, the dead man and this family knock on the front doors or bedroom windows, asking their wives and daughters to be let back in. Some of the fathers in this family supported heads that turned away from the women and children until they either dissolved or died, while other men in this family were born already dead. These stories go back for centuries, fathers and brothers and husbands asking for forgiveness after dying too young or too mean from drink. And for a millennium, the women in this family forgave the ghost and sent him on his way to whatever waits in the after. It was Patrick, Flora's husband, and Nana's father, tap-tapping at the window for forgiveness. Patrick was not a mean drunk when he was alive, Nana told me. She said that she never heard her father raise his voice in her life. He was the only saddler in Derry, Northern Ireland, where she grew up, working and conditioning leather into saddles, shoes, messenger bags, and belts. Exceptional. Until he got drunk. One night, whiskey swimming in his belly, Patrick bet the saddler shop in a poker game with his brother. His eyes were half-masked. Everything changed after that. He died working the leather on the floor of his living room, his children grown and out of the house, his life's work lost, the fluttering shuffle in the hands of a brother. And so he begged his wife, Flora, to forgive him in death like he had done the night he'd come drunk home with the news. She forbade playing cards after that. She said they were the work of the devil. Nana used to slap them out of my hands. "Me mammy forbade it, and so do I," she'd say. But later, when I began to read tarot, she'd come down to her table in the middle of the night, and she'd ask me what the cards said about her dead husband and her first boyfriend, the man she still loved in the cell of her heart. She'd boil tea and read my tea leaves, something else she kept secret. "Please forgive me," dead Patrick said to Flora at the window. "Please forgive me, Flora." Flora pulled the nightgown over her head and looked to her dead husband and said, "Go to sleep now, Patty." She blessed herself as the man dissolved and Flora turned out the light. Rosaline. Years and years later, Nana's brother was sitting on her bed when she woke up in the middle of the night. She looked at the alarm clock but couldn't read the numbers. The digits whirred into a blur. The mattress springs creaked and she turned to him. Her brother's shoulders shook with sobbing. "They won't let me up there," he told her. Nana's brother was a mean drunk, threatened to drive his wife mad after his death. He promised he'd come back as a voice and she'd walk the streets talking to herself by the time he was through with her. The promise never came true, but his words clanged on the roof of his wife's head for decades. To Nana, this night, her brother appeared as a hunched over boy, begging his sister for help. "Deep down, you're a good man," Nana told her brother ghost, "if a tortured and invisible one." She kicked the blankets off her feet and knees. Doing something wrong. Hello? Okay, so Nana's brother was a mean drunk, threatened to drive his wife mad after his death. He promised he'd come back as a voice, and he would walk the streets talking to herself by the time he was through with her. The promise never came true, but the words clanged on the roof of his wife's head for decades. "Deep down, you're a good man," Nana told her brother ghost, "if a tortured and invisible one." She kicked off the blankets off her feet and leaned in. All the men in this family are cursed," she said. "All of them afflicted with some evil disease they can't help. All of them bastards." She remembered her brother convincing their mother to forgive Nana when she ran away and married an American. She remembered their mother finally opening the door and letting in her new husband, my grandfather, past the threshold. She remembered her brother's shining eyes just over her mother's shoulder. "It's all right now, you see." She remembered her brother's own young bride when he also immigrated to America. Their little house, their redheaded girl. She remembered how lovely and handsome her brother was before alcohol twisted him up. So Nana prayed with him because she remembered. The siblings held hands as Nana hushed the Lord's Prayer and her backyard lit up like morning. A searing brightness cut her eyes and stung her nose and her brother zipped up with the light. Monique. It's perhaps easier to imagine all of us women without a father at all. My mother was born out of Nana like a splitting cell. Her father's face never rotated towards her unless he was drunk. His head swiveled on his neck perpetually. At dinner, he stayed silent and never ate. The trunk of his body sat facing forward, but his eyes and mouth backwards turned towards the grinding clock. After he cracked a beer, his face would roll towards them and blistered and splattered spit. My mother hit her father once. She found him kicking her brother's ribs with his steel-toed boots. She grabbed the lacquered shillelagh Nana hung over the doorway and clubbed him over the head with it. How Irish of her to crack her father with a souvenir from Nana's hometown of Derry. I sat in awe listening to my mother's story. Nana's house darkened and vacant. We carried her antique mirror through the rose garden. Our girl was dead, and so were all the men. We carried her house into the night, heaving boxes into our cars. When we were done, Mom sat under the green arbor full of wisteria and told me. She said that the way her father's arms stiffened, his hands cocked and crooked as lightning bolts blinked right through her. Her body flooded and her father dropped. Her older brother, a curled ball, a small pebble on the red carpet, unclenched himself and looked up at his sister. Nana stood, stunned at the girl she made, the girl who made me, the girl stunned at herself. My mother taught me that to fight is an act of forgiveness. If she had never had any faith in her father, why would she have bothered? When I was a toddler, my grandfather hit me. My mother grabbed him by the chin and said, if you ever do that again, and he didn't. I don't have this memory. In my mind, he was the barrel of a man who fawned. He'd never turned his head backwards. He was the man who cried every time I sang or read a book out loud. And I remember my mother just over his shoulder. Her father never visited her as a ghost, but his violence haunted my mother while I toddled under his knees or bust through the office door with a fistful of flowers. Me. My mother and grandmother also taught me that daughters inherit their fathers and brothers and become responsible for them, become their keepers. You're the only one he will listen to. We were all told it. My father started to dissolve when I was 7. My mother says she married him because my grandfather forced it. And maybe she loved my father, or maybe she would come to loving him later. After my own wedding, she told me she never wanted to get divorced. But one thing I know for sure, she married him because she was pregnant with me. First to dissolve was my father's pinky finger. He came home and said, I've only 4 fingers, to nobody in particular. And then his right knee, and then his left foot, and so on. His backwards turned head was the last to leave. It floated into the house, crowned by a halo of marble smoke. Beer cans levitated to his face and down again. His angry red mouth slurped and burped. By the time I was in high school, the whole of him had disappeared. And for a decade, he remained invisible. All you could see were the contents of his stomach, swirling liquor, a walking, sloshing liquid mass entered the room and floated by the television. When I was old enough and angry enough, I told him to never call me again. I told him he would never know his grandchildren. I might as well have swung and punched him. Eventually, years later, he called and begged me to come find him. He had drunk himself into homelessness. By grace or curse or inheritance, I got in my car and I drove. Something told me not to, to know better. My mind churned out scenarios, but something else in me, like a magnetic spool of thread winding, told me to answer the tap-tapping at the window. Please forgive me, Flora. On the side of a highway outside Pittsburgh, his boots appeared in the mop bucket snow, and I pulled the car in, cut the ignition. Then his lanky legs seeped into focus. Next, his boyish hands. Cars whizzed by in the slosh. I unlocked the doors and told his knees to get in.
No, he was only.
Though he was only hands and legs, he smelled. Steel-toed boots sopping, the limbs shook, the fingers lightning cooked and cocked. I can't do this anymore, his voice said, though he had no head. The rest of him swiveled towards me, and like a pressed face through a veil, my father glimmered into focus, and my body blinked. In 4 years' time, my father would walk me towards a man who had disappeared once, my husband, who I'd met at a bar called The Cage. We drank too much the first time around, didn't connect under all that muddled mint and frosted glass and shellacked wood on our teeth. He broke up with me, who's here in the back if you want to remind me. He broke up with me on his front porch after pouring a beer and telling me he was sorry. I drove off to a friend's house and got drunk in his backyard, golden fizzy pale ale with a frothy top. The friend told me good riddance. No one liked him. I agreed, even though I knew it wasn't true. My husband reappeared after I wrote a book about my father. He read the story of how alcohol can steal a man from himself and water him down to drowning. He bought my book and called, and I asked him to dinner. I wanted to sit across from him and gloat. See what you did? See how stupid it was to disappear? We both ate curry chips in a sweaty booth. Instead of appearing all at once, he sharpened into focus. I could see every freckle, the lines etched into the corners of his ears. It was the first time I'd heard him belly laugh, clear-eyed, head back and shaking the booth. We talked and talked about our fathers, our broken hearts, and how we both disappeared when we were younger, into whiskey glasses and highball glasses and shot glasses and long-stemmed wine glasses and cracked cans and amber bottles. Back then, the first time we dated, I wrote poems and I drank. I walked drunk into the night barefoot until my feet bled from cut glass. The ghosts of the mothers and fathers before me clambered on ahead and I barreled right through them like a blind ram. Men can disappear, but women can too. Into violence or poetry or prayer or ghost stories passed down, into fairy tales and folklore to avoid the more obvious, harder truth. Women and men muddled under all the other women and men before us. It's the same old story you've always heard. I played it out on him and he played it out on me. In the booth, I knew I'd marry this man who had disappeared. I could feel our legs turning to roots beneath the table. And later, as my father walked me down the aisle, he kept looking down. "So you don't fall," he said. "So we both get there in one piece. Slow down now, it's not a race." My mother was there too, divorced from my father for over 20 years. And the photo of us together, a family, reappears. Our image burns clear in black and white in front of the brick and ivy of an old Pittsburgh inn, a grandmother's ashes encased in a necklace around a bride's neck, a white dress stitched with yellow silk flowers and green vines, a husband squinting in the afternoon sun, and a mother and father laughing, holding on to their daughter. Thanks.